From Hemming Park to local names of schools, more relics of a shameful past are on their way to being retitled. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, Hemming Park is getting a new name, though not without some controversy. Local schools could be getting new names as well soon. Give us a call as we talk about this. It's 549-2937. Then later, how the pandemic is affecting criminal justice in America. Speaking of that, here is the latest on the COVID crisis by the numbers statewide. The Department of Health reports nearly 480,000 cases and 7,402 deaths. That's a one-day increase of 245. We need to note major testing sites were closed down over the weekend and into Monday with the threat of Tropical Storm Isaias, which tamped down the numbers somewhat. In our area, the death toll stands at 276. In other news this week, a move to rename Hemming Park after James Weldon Johnson, perhaps the city's most famous resident, ran into opposition this week. Local veterans groups made a late-breaking push to rechristen the city's first and oldest park as Veterans Memorial Park. Johnson, of course, composed the famous anthem, Lift Every Voice and Sing, among many other accomplishments. Okay, so there's been a compromise proposed for the Hemming Park rename. We'll talk about that in a moment. At the same time, the Duval County School Board says it's going to launch a process to consider naming three schools in our area, three more schools, Andrew Jackson High, Jean Ribault High, and Jean Ribault Middle. The namesakes of these schools are all tied to a history of racism and the marginalization of Native Americans, too. So as we talk about Hemming Park's renaming, and the potential renaming of these schools, there's a lot of history to get into, which is why we're pleased to welcome an eminent guest. It's Earl Johnson Jr., the founder of TakeItDown.org. He's on the line now. Earl, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
Good to have you back on the show. We should note Take It Down is a national organization working to take down Confederate monuments across the nation. And as we talk about this issue, we want your calls. What are your thoughts and questions about the renaming of Hemming Park and potentially more local schools? It's 549-2937 to join us. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page, already getting your comments. Okay, so Earl, it looks as though there is a compromise about the renaming of Hemming Park. It will be named after civil rights legend James Weldon Johnson, who hailed from Jacksonville, perhaps the city's most famous citizen. At the same time, there's going to be a Veterans Memorial Plaza inside the park. This is being billed by some on the city council as an acceptable compromise. What's your reaction?
I think it presents a lot of confusion. I really didn't understand why we were looking for a compromise. Keep in mind, we're talking about Hemming Plaza, Charles Hemming, a Confederate who, by definition, was a traitor of America, denounced his American citizenship. The park has had many names, City Park, St. James Park, and it was only after Hemming indicated that he was going to present what, at the time, was a six-figure monument, 62 feet tall, that the park was named after him in 1899. So I think it's always important when you're dealing with the renaming of Confederate monuments, tributes, honorariums, you really need to start firstly with an understanding of what the Confederacy was in terms of it being the first government founded upon white supremacy. And I don't say that. You simply have to look to the cornerstone speech, Alexander Stevens' speech of 1861, wherein just a few weeks before the Civil War, he absolutely rejects the American notion that all men are created equal. And I quote, "Our new government is founded upon exactly the opposite ideas. Its foundations are laid, its cornerstone rests upon the great truth that the Negro is not equal to the white man, that slavery, subordination to the superior race, is his natural in normal condition. This, our new government, is the first in the history of the world based upon this great physical, philosophical, and moral truth. The second such government in the world was Hitler's Third Reich. He was a big fan of the Confederacy and what it stood for. And so when you see these monuments on public land, and the Smithsonian says we spend about $40 million a year around the country every several years on these, and they're all over the place. They're in northern states. They're in states that didn't exist at the time of the Civil War, Hawaii, Alaska. You see a concerted effort over the last 155 years to tell a lie, to try to take the narrative away from the fact that the Confederacy was the world's largest group of American traders bent on destroying America for the sole purpose of maintaining the enslavement of Black Americans. And so what I see is a continuing inability to address that history. I'm often, Melissa, faced with comments in terms of what we're doing with takeitdown.org, like, you know, you can't change history. That is true. You cannot change history, but you can certainly lie about history. And we have experienced a 155-year lie about the Confederacy. And so I think it's important to start there. Absolutely, James Weldon Johnson, and no relation, James Weldon Johnson is clearly the most notable Jacksonvillian in our history. He, born in 1871, he became the first Black member of the Florida bar, if you will, after Reconstruction, the first Black attorney in Florida. He was a teacher. He was appointed by Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, from 1906 to 1913 as counsel to Venezuela and Nicaragua. He was the first Black faculty member of New York University. And of course, he wrote the famed song, Lift Every Voice and Sing, which is often referred to as the Black National Anthem. The song is so popular, Melissa, that if you Google Lift, just put Lift in, after the term Lift comes up, Lift Every Voice and Sing comes up. So that gives you an idea.
Right. And we need to point out, too, that it's so beloved and so well-known that the NFL now says it will play Lift Every Voice and Sing, also known as the Black National Anthem, before the kickoff at all of its season opening games. Maybe not this year, since we may not have an NFL season, but once we get through this pandemic, James Weldon Johnson's legacy will live on via the NFL. And so that gives you an idea of just how influential he was. Now, we'll go to your calls in a moment for Earl Johnson Jr. at 549-2937. In a little bit, we'll talk a little more deeply about your group, Earl, takeitdown.org. But as we talk about Hemming Park being renamed for James Weldon Johnson and this compromise, which has pleased local veterans but has not sat well with civil rights advocates and many African Americans in this community, I want to ask you as a follow-up question your reaction to the other news that came down last night. The Duval County School Board is looking at renaming more schools. Andrew Jackson High, Jean Rabeau High, and Jean Rabeau Middle. They began by the six schools named for Confederate officers. Now, according to board member Ashley Smith-Juarez, they're going to continue with looking at renaming schools named for people responsible, and I'm quoting here, for systematically marginalizing and killing indigenous people. Your thoughts about this news?
Well, our namesake would certainly be included in that group, wouldn't he? You know,
You mean Jacksonville?
Yes. Jacksonville's namesake. We are, of course, experiencing a racial reckoning in our country, which has a lot to do with the fact that we've been unable to address our history. And so we're evolving. I see that we are evolving as a country. We're evolving as a nation. It's important for us to take a look and see where we are honoring those who don't deserve that tribute. And that's okay to do that. I would suggest, though, that the idea that you can't name the park after James Weldon Johnson or any schools after individuals from this point forward is a false argument. Of course you can. We're just naming them after individuals who we believe reflect best of the kind of community, the kind of city that we want to be. And so I don't think there's anything wrong with taking a look at these naming honorariums. You know, Jacksonville continues, now that Richmond took down its Confederate Avenue, Jacksonville continues to be the world's foremost collection of monuments, honorariums, naming schools after the Confederacy. And so,
wait a minute. You're saying there are more place names or monuments or buildings in Jacksonville named after Confederate figures than any other city? Is that accurate?
In the world.
Really? And how many do we have total?
I think we're at 11 right now. That may not include the six schools that are named for Confederates. So after Richmond, Virginia took down its Monument Avenue, Jacksonville, our city, and granted, we were not a Confederate capital, you would think we were, has more monuments, tributes, honorariums than anywhere else. And so we're a little disappointed that after the Hemming Plaza statue was taken down in the wee hours of the evening back in June, now we really haven't heard too much out of the administration, the mayoral administration, about its plans moving forward. You know, Councilman Garrett proposed the name change for Hemming nearly 2 months ago. And so for him to be blindsided at committee this week with the proposal that it be named the Veterans Memorial just really didn't make a lot of sense. Of course, one of the most prominent structures in our city is the arena, and it's named after the Veterans Memorial, and we love our veterans. We have a very large veteran population in our great city. But it just seemed insincere to pit this civil rights legend against veteran organizations. It just didn't make a lot of sense to me. I read the proposal for the compromise, and it talked about a quote-unquote joint community. I don't even know what that means. I think we're one community. We're not two communities. Some of the comments of the city council members this week during that discussion were extraordinary. One white council member, I think, said that he didn't want to bring racism into the conversation over the debate of changing the Confederate named park. So the unwillingness to even address the history is a stark problem. But I think it's a good debate for us to have. We need to have this debate. We need to talk about these renamings. And the community has to be a part of this, of course.
Right. And I want to get to some calls as we talk about this issue right now with Earl Johnson Jr. His organization is called TakeItDown.org. It's a national organization working to take down monuments and markers to the Confederacy, including here in our area. Earl Johnson Jr. is the son of Earl Johnson, who was a leading civic and civil rights figure in this community and was the attorney to Martin Luther King Jr., among other accomplishments. So give us a call with your thoughts, 549-2937. Darren is in Fleming Island. Darren, good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Thank you for having me. I'm someone who's lived in Houston, Texas.
We're having a little trouble here. Roll your window up, Darren. We can barely hear you.
Okay. Let me switch you to...
That's better.
Is that better?
Yeah, much better.
Okay. So I'm someone who's lived in Houston, Texas. I've lived in Fayetteville, North Carolina, home of the 82nd Airborne, Massachusetts, and New Jersey. And of all the places I've lived, Jacksonville has really done a fantastic job honoring its veterans with naming of buildings and monuments and special events. However, we've not done a great job naming places for cultural icons. And this is just one of those things that seems like it's a no-brainer to me. Why do we need another Veterans Memorial?
All right. Thanks, Darren. That point has been brought up, Earl. Some tweets coming into the show about this. Here's one from Anne Marie. Johnson's name is on buildings in other states, a library in St. Pete, on the Episcopal Church liturgical calendar, on a U.S. Postal Service stamp. And we can't seem to find the courage to name a little 1.5-acre park in his name. Why is this so hard? Signed, 24-year Navy vet. And so we have heard from some local veterans who have said, you know, we've gotten enough props. We don't necessarily need more. Not every veteran feels that way, though, we need to point out, because the veterans groups that came to city council, were able to secure the naming of a plaza within Heming Park, although the park itself will be named after Johnson. So for those who are a little confused about this, that's what has been apparently decided. But Earl, what about that? Do you think the city has done enough to honor its veterans?
Well, I think we're always honoring our veterans, right? That's part of being American. And we've done a wonderful job here. I know that we have over 100,000 Navy personnel and veterans in our community. And so it's important that we recognize those who've given often the highest sacrifice. But Jacksonville's history in civil rights is extraordinary. It is an extraordinary history, and we have not done a very good job recognizing it. And I would take the position that having the memorial, Veterans Memorial Plaza or park within the James Weldon Johnson Park is so confusing, and it's unnecessary. James Weldon Johnson is an international figure. James Weldon Johnson commands that 1.3 acres. And so the notion that he needs to be bolstered by some other names or other honorariums in the park as we change the name from a Confederate, I reject that notion.
Lots of feedback coming in. Andy emails the show. The only reason they needed to reach a compromise on the renaming of Heming Park is because the park was slated to be renamed after a black man. These remnants of resentment who are holding our society back are making their last gasp of influence before disappearing into the dark reaches of a disreputable past, he says. Here's a tweet from the Urban Core. Check out Along This Way, Johnson's autobiography, a great read, but especially interesting if you're in Duval. James Weldon Johnson was a true American icon. Here's a tweet from one of our digital partners, the Jackson Digital Magazine. Seems we're doing everything in silos. Whatever happened to the community engagement process before a unilateral council decision to select from only two names, they say, Earl. You know, this bill by Garrett Dennis had been on the docket for a bit, few months.
Yeah.
And do you feel maybe the community should have had more engagement, or perhaps the council felt that would have dragged out the process even more, made it too messy?
You know, I think there needs to be a balance struck, right, between the community input and the council members being leaders of our community, representatives of our community, and taking action. I was concerned that the issue of renaming it Veterans Memorial didn't come to the forefront until this week. And the bill to rename it James Weldon Johnson had been out there for about 2 months. So it just seemed a last gasp effort to railroad the effort to change it to James Weldon Johnson. And unfortunately, what I see is using veterans organizations as pawns in that effort. And so I don't disagree with the sincerity of veterans organizations who are looking for another naming opportunity. I do disagree with the sincerity or lack of sincerity in pitting those groups against the effort to rename the park after a civil rights icon. And so That is the problem. The notion that James Weldon Johnson doesn't command the name of that park solely, I think that's part of the problem.
Yeah. And we do need to note that there have been plenty of veterans of color who have served this country, including enslaved people. Now, let me ask you about this, Earl. Yesterday on a great program we carry on this station, Fresh Air, the host, Terry Gross, interviewed the Pulitzer Prize-winning author Isabel Wilkerson about her new book, Cast, which I recommend everybody read. I'm going to get a copy as soon as I can. I had not been aware of the book until I heard this interview. And in this book, which is really, really important, Wilkerson talks about America, Nazi Germany, and India as the three societies who have created and, in the case of India and the U.S., maintained a caste system. And in India, the caste system is a lot more complex. Nazi Germany's caste system was dismantled. But in America, we still have a caste system. And we are now, with this movement that we're living through, seeing the long-delayed process of trying to dismantle some of the infrastructure of caste. And these monuments and markers and names are part of that. And so what I think Isabel Wilkerson would say is that the resistance to just flat up naming the park after Johnson without anything else attached to it is part of an effort to at least maintain some of those traditional underpinnings of caste, wherein the white group is the dominant caste. And African Americans are the subordinate caste. And I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Well, when you look at these monuments on public land, they're paid for by taxpayers of all colors, and they're on the courthouse steps, they're in the parks, and you ask yourself, is this a governmental endorsement of the Confederacy? I would suggest no. It is a governmental endorsement of white supremacy. And so when black children have to play in the shadows of these parks, of these monuments rather, in their city park, when black and brown people are walking into the courthouse to seek justice and have to pass by one of these monuments to the enslaver, it is a stark reminder to black people that there is a continuing effort to rewrite history, a continuing effort to impose the vestiges of white supremacy. And so that is what we're talking about here. And granted, it wasn't taught in school. You know, only two states in the country mention white supremacy in their history books. Okay. 16 states don't refer to slavery at all as it relates to a reason for the Civil War. They say that quote unquote states' rights was what it's about. I remember being in school here in Jacksonville, and suddenly everybody in class became an engineer learning all about the cotton gin and the evils of Eli Whitney, and that was the explanation for the Civil War. That was Duval County's explanation. So, you know, we have not gotten it right. We don't have a national standard for teaching our children the history of our great country. And so unless and until we get it right when it comes to teaching history, we will always be wrong in terms of understanding its effects today. You know,
And Earl, we're running tight on time, but before we go to break, I wanted to have you quickly talk about your group, takeitdown.org. By the way, here's a tweet from Steve. Please point out the number of monuments in Richmond, Virginia alone numbered in the dozens. So he took issue with your claim that we had the most here in Jacksonville. When you reference Richmond, Virginia, the capital of the Confederacy. But anyway, if you could talk quickly about the progress you've made with takeitdown.org.
Thank you very much, Melissa. Well, with regard to Richmond, Richmond had a Memorial Avenue, which it's begun to dismantle. And my point is that when that comes down, and it's already coming down, Jacksonville will be number one, the world's foremost. But
I see.
So we were looking at, there was no national plan, no national organization that we saw that was able to give the kind of clearinghouse assistance to the local organizations that are involved in these efforts. So around the country, you know, what in Texas, you've got communities where judges decide whether the monuments come down. We've seen here in Jacksonville, the mayor take it down. We've seen the committees or various different bodies around the country. So there's no uniform way, there's no uniform decision makers as it relates to these monuments. And so what we've done is provide assistance to the individuals and organizations around the country that are involved in these grassroots efforts. We have a three-plank platform. One is re-education. We've talked about that a lot today. The second is creating this national network of these organizations, and we're well underway with that. We've gotten a great response. And then thirdly is funding, direct funding for these local efforts as they work through this process. And so we certainly don't condone violence. We don't condone spray painting. We condone and we encourage going through the processes, wherever they may be, to have the decision makers come to the conclusion that their communities are better off without these vestiges of hate in their parks. You know,
And we'll have to leave it there. Yeah. I want to thank you, Earl Johnson Jr. of TakeItDown.org on the line for us. Several people just called in, but we have to move on because we have more guests coming. So, Earl, thank you so much, and keep us posted.
Thank you, Melissa.
Much more still ahead. A look at some good news from the week in our What's Good Wednesdays. That's later, but up next.
And this would be the third million square foot plus Amazon fulfillment center in Jacksonville.
Amazon expanding in Jacksonville and hiring too. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm a reporter, and you've probably heard me on this station. When I'm putting together a story, sometimes it can start off feeling like kind of a mess. There are times when there's a lot of information to comb through, and it's also just really been a long day. But I have editors who might ask me to make another phone call or double-check a statistic. A lot goes into making sure our stories are fair and accurate. I'm Sky LeBron, and this is WJCT News 89.9.
Electro Lounge can now be heard 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on WJCT 89.9 HD4 Electro Lounge Radio or on the WJCT app. Electro Lounge Radio, part of the Jacksonville Music Experience.
Welcome back. Well, Amazon is expanding its footprint here in Jacksonville. With more, I spoke with Karen Bruni Mathis of the Jax Daily Record. Karen, good to talk to you.
Great to talk with you.
So tell us about your big scoop. The city has issued a permit for another Amazon distribution center in Jacksonville.
Well, what's happening is that the developer has applied for a permit, and this would be the third million square foot plus Amazon fulfillment center in Jacksonville. And I think what the big news is, this means that in less than 3 years, Amazon has opened or started developing more than 4 million square feet of fulfillment and delivery space in Northeast Florida. And we don't know exactly the employment count, but I know that they have expected to employ at least 5,000 people in Northeast Florida.
That's a lot of jobs. That said, Amazon has also come under a lot of criticism for its working conditions at these centers. What do we know about these jobs and what employees can expect?
Well, I think when you talk about the fulfillment centers, what you have is the requirement that people be on their feet. And the requirements actually are in the job descriptions, and it looks like it's something that, you know, you're going to have to put some time in when you do these jobs. I know some people who have these jobs and they really enjoy them, but at the same time, we hear of conditions that people don't like these jobs so much, and that there are a lot of requirements.
Right. These are labor jobs, often in not a climate-controlled space. They're high pressure. There are complaints about other working conditions. Amazon has pushed back against these criticisms. And certainly in this time of recession, people are going to take any job that they can. And so why do you think Amazon has eyed Jacksonville as a location for several now, it looks like, of these fulfillment centers?
I think you said it. It is location. From Jacksonville, you can, first of all, Jacksonville's a pretty big market. So when you have these last mile centers, and we have one, and there are at least two more coming, and I know that Amazon is looking all throughout the area for locations for these, you have a dense population that's doing a lot more ordering online now, especially during the pandemic when people aren't as comfortable going out to shop. And you see that also reflected in what's happening with retail stores. At the same time, the larger distribution centers, this means that we serve an area probably going well into South Georgia, going west and going pretty far south. So Jacksonville's location is why I think we are getting the larger fulfillment centers. We have one for what's called larger goods, one for smaller like books and Kindles, and the new one that will be going into Imus and Parker's is for what is called soft lines, and that is clothing.
Hmm. And what does this mean for the North Side? As you report in the Daily Record, they are eyeing the Imus and Park area on Jacksonville's north side for this new Amazon fulfillment center?
Well, I think it could mean at least 1,000 jobs. We don't know yet how many jobs, but you look at parking spaces, and there are parking spaces that will be for 1,500 cars. And so that means that they expect that they might need 1,500 parking spaces. Perhaps that would include the seasonal work because you will have much more work during the holidays. But it does mean a lot of jobs up there in North Jacksonville. And this area is not too far from the zoo area. It's up on Main Street and Zoo Parkway. And, you know, that area needs jobs as much as any part of North Jacksonville does. So I think that it'll probably be a good move for the workforce.
And these jobs are not minimum wage jobs, correct, but a little above that pay grade. Is that right?
I think what you find in the others, it's going to be like $10 to $15 an hour. So for the basic workforce, for the bulk of the workforce, you will have some higher paid jobs in management and in the running of the center. But, you know, the workers on the floor are the ones who are probably going to be paid in that pay range. But with demand, sometimes if you're trying to get the workforce, you might pay a little bit more.
And so as we wait to hear more, how do people typically, when the word spreads throughout Jacksonville that these jobs could be coming, how do people go through the process of applying with Amazon, and how competitive is it to get hired on at one of these places?
Well, the first thing is you would probably go to Amazon.com and check on careers. There also are a lot of job websites that people are familiar with that you could just, you know, type in on your browser, Amazon Jobs in Jacksonville, and see what all pops up. There a lot of times will be an outreach in the area when the job applications are being taken. But for the first couple application periods for the first fulfillment centers, there were a lot of people in line for those jobs. So we know that people want to work and they want to try to get a job at Amazon.
Well, Karen Bruni Mathis, always first with these stories. Thank you so much. More about this on our website and at the Jax Daily Record. She's editor Karen Bruni Mathis. Thanks, Karen.
Thanks, Melissa.
Well, the American Journal of Criminal Justice at UNF is out with a special issue looking at crime and justice during the coronavirus pandemic, highlighting immigration issues, policing, and the overall crisis to corrections presented by COVID. Mitch Miller and Holly Ventura Miller are criminal justice professors at UNF, and they're on the line with more. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good to have you. Holly, let's start with you. There are lots of crime and justice issues highlighted in this issue, but let's begin with the correctional crisis, how the pandemic is presenting a huge problem inside the nation's correctional facilities. What will we learn in this special report?
Well, you will learn some of the preliminary data that's associated with the problems being presented from COVID to correctional facilities, which include prisons, jails, and also immigration detention facilities. Some of these include what would be rather obvious. Detention facilities are generally very crowded, difficult to maintain social distancing. They are often not well resourced, which means they do not have the PPE, the personal protective equipment, on hand, oftentimes not even for the staff, never mind the detainees and inmates that are being held there.
Right. Hotbeds of the disease. Mitch Miller, we've been hearing reports about this from the correctional facilities right here in Florida. This is really worrisome. And is the correction system trying to do anything about this?
Well, much like the national policy response to the virus in general, it's very bifurcated and individualized from state to state and also within states. A lot of community corrections are run at the county level under the oversight of sheriff's offices, so there can be considerable variability in how things are handled, even in adjacent counties.
All right. And then going beyond corrections, you also look at immigration policy and justice in the area of COVID. Holly, this involves everything from court challenges to ICE enforcement and conditions in detention facilities, ICE detention facilities. What will we learn there?
So again, we tried to look at some of the preliminary evidence that was available, and a lot of this evidence is available from ICE, from Immigration and Customs Enforcement, that have certainly gotten better over the course of the pandemic in terms of making their data more available. But the three things that we look at in particular are whether or not ICE enforcement actions are continuing during the pandemic. There is some evidence that suggests that despite the concerns and dangers associated with this, that is still going on. We also look at detention facilities themselves, as we alluded to a little bit ago with correctional facilities more broadly. These are often under-resourced. These are often overpopulated. And generally speaking, they do not have the structure or the logistics to do what the CDC recommends. And finally, we take a look at deportations. This involves a little bit just more than the pandemic because it's situated within broader policy changes that have been instituted by the Trump administration over the past few years. But one of the biggest concerns that we looked at was whether or not ICE detention facilities in their deportation practices were actually deporting COVID cases back to these countries of origin. And the preliminary evidence does indeed suggest that deportees in places such as Guatemala and Colombia and Jamaica have tested positive upon arriving back in their home countries following deportation.
So, Mitch, going beyond these individual articles, there's sort of a 30,000-foot view on this, too, the need for a national COVID crime and justice research agenda. What would that agenda look like?
Well, I think it will be a work in progress, sort of a situation of we make the road by walking. It'll be a function of the sum of all the research of the different crime and justice researchers around the country. But that was really the impetus of this special issue. We were real fortunate to have, I was able to have Alfred Bloomstein, who's one of the leading criminologists in the nation for several decades, joined me in the initial introductory article, which tries to specify a general framework for a national research agenda, not so much to dictate in any way what others will choose to examine and inquire and explore with various scientific approaches, but instead to create a general conceptual basis that could be a referral base to unify and synthesize all the different individual efforts. So simply stated, this is rooted around cornerstone concepts of contagion, containment, and increasingly, because while this issue was put together very quickly and come to print very quickly as well, especially in scientific journal time, which sometimes our normal issues can lag several months, the situation is already changing as the virus spikes and continues to change, and as different states take different policy positions. Increasingly, just since the issue has come out, and this is only compounded more so by the criminal justice reform movement and specifically the BLM protests, but there's going to be a challenge to law enforcement manpower around the country as officer retention becomes an increasing concern, as a lot of people are just retiring early, and on the front end there's fewer new applicants as well. I think another emerging theme specific to the virus that the special issue has a couple of police articles that address will be social ordinance compliance enforcement. So there's likely to be additional changes as well, because one thing that the virus has done, which is sort of a one-in-a-lifetime reality opportunity for researchers, is it's creating a lot of natural experimental conditions that otherwise would not exist. Yeah. Specifically, the widespread release of offenders from jails in many places around the country, especially throughout the South.
Lots to get into. This new issue from the American Journal of Criminal Justice at UNF is out. UNF.edu for more. It's Crime and Justice During the Pandemic. Mitch Miller and Holly Ventura Miller, both teaching criminal justice at the University of North Florida. Thank you both so much for this important research. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having us.
A quick break, and in a moment, heads up, everybody, free tacos. We'll tell you how to get them, plus some other good news for your Wednesday. Don't go away.
Congaree and Penn, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering picnic meals in a safe, dog-friendly farm setting where social distancing is top priority. Visit congareeandpenn.com for more information. WinGuard Marketing and Communications Agency, committed to businesses, nonprofits, and marketing teams to help develop data-driven advertising plans for Jacksonville and beyond. More information on WinGuard's services can be found at wearewinguard.com.
Katniss Everdeen is the Hunger Games protagonist who must save the day. Rue is a young girl who dies early in the story, and you can probably guess which character is white and which is black. Ebony Elizabeth Thomas joins us to talk about how a lack of diversity in popular books reflects a lack of imagination, which she writes about in The Dark Fantastic. That's next time on Think. Tonight at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Caregivers across the country are finding that there's a new resume item in demand for families, a coronavirus survivor.
People are going to be put in this sort of deadly dilemma of, do I infect myself in order to work?
I'm Molly Wood, the deadly dilemma caregivers are facing. That's next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6 on WJCT News 89.9.
Theaters have gone dark. A few have gone online. But in every state, venues for the live arts face oblivion. It's impacting more than artists, organizers, and owners. Local businesses also rely on the foot traffic generated by these events. I'm Jen White. We bailed out the banks. Should we now do the same for the arts? Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, who doesn't love those tasty tacos at Burrito Gallery? The beloved eatery is earning even more fans now. Yeah, they're going to give 10 lucky winners free tacos every single day for the rest of the year. Burrito Gallery founding partner Tony Allegretti is on the line with more about this. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Melissa. Thank you for having me on. You know,
it's great to have you. Hey, so Burrito Gallery giving away 10 tacos a day, 10 lucky winners every single day for the rest of 2020. Who's eligible to get these tacos?
Thank you for asking. Teachers, healthcare workers, grocery workers, restaurant workers, first responders, and we included artists. You know, artists are already, it's really tough to be an artist and make a living, but we know that we've got hungry artists out there. So all of those categories, and not a lot of people are doing this, so it's very likely, or I should say a good percentage chance that you could really help out one of these frontline heroes if you participate.
Now, everyone needs to follow Burrito Gallery on Instagram and Twitter because you'll pick some random winners, too, for the free tacos, right?
That's right, yeah. So you can nominate folks, and that's an easy way to get a lot of hugs. But you can also, just by following Twitter and Instagram, you could be selected randomly as well. And we're going to do 10 people. It's 138 tacos for the rest of the year, which we think is going to be great.
That is so great. And you're just doing this as a goodwill gesture, right? Because times are tough.
It's really tough right now. And, you know, we wanted, 2020 is just such a terrible year news-wise, you know, non-taco related news, I should say. And so we wanted to put some smiles on folks' face and really thank those people that are out there that have had to work through this, having to go back to work, et cetera. And we really wanted to do something that we could do nice. And your voucher can work. So when you win, you can use it at any of our restaurants and get a free taco every day. No
Excellent.
Purchase necessary. Yeah.
That is great. So if you're a teacher, grocery worker, first responder, healthcare worker, restaurant employee, or artist, get to the nearest Burrito Gallery. 10 free tacos every day to people that qualify for the rest of the year. So great to hear this. Tony, always good to hear your voice. Thanks for doing what you can to spread a little light.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
And follow Burrito Gallery on social media for more about this. It is Wednesday, so we're going to highlight some more good news right now. Speaking of feeding the masses, Southeastern Grocers is helping battle hunger across the Southeast through its initiative Share a Meal. Just go to your local Harvey's or Winn-Dixie store, buy a deli item and participating Coca-Cola product, and part of your purchase will go toward Feeding America food banks, which is great to see. More downward-facing dogs for everybody, Yoga for Change, and Bold Bean Coffee Roasters Jack's Beach are partnering up. For the entire month of August, Bold Bean is donating 10% of its iced coffee sales to Yoga for Change. So if you get an iced coffee there, you will help bring the healing power of yoga to veterans, troubled youth, people who are incarcerated, people struggling with mental illness. This is such a great initiative. Kudos to both of those organizations. And St. Mary's, Georgia, getting some pub. St. Mary's is one of those magical, laid-back southern coastal towns you've got to visit sometime. Southern Living Magazine has included St. Mary's on its list of the South's best small towns for 2020. They also made USA Today's top 10 list of best coastal small towns. Great job, St. Mary's, Georgia. And folks, when you head up there, you need to also hop aboard the ferry that takes you out to Cumberland Island, another must-visit spot. Now, if you've got some good news for us, we want to hear about it, because every Wednesday on this show, we spotlight what's good in this community. We all need some good news in this pandemic and recession. We also send out a What's Good Wednesday e-newsletter each week, bringing you up to date on stuff that has caught our eye here on the show. You can subscribe to it. Just go to WJCT.org and sign up for your What's Good Wednesdays. And if you have some good news you want us to add to our weekly menu, email us. It's easy, firstcoastconnect@WJCT.org, and we'll try to get your good news on if we can. Well, that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Station News Director is Jessica Palumbo, and Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor here at WJCT. As I said, keep those emails coming. We really value your feedback. firstcoastconnect@WJCT.org. And if you missed any part of today's show, it airs tonight, once again, and every night at 8 o'clock. Now, you can also, if you prefer, download our podcast, also up at our website or wherever you like to get your favorite podcasts. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Have a great Wednesday, and please, everybody, wear your mask.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.